Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Tuesday, 19th of January, 2021. And just a brief note at the top of the show, please, if you're enjoying the podcast and we're getting a nicely growing audience, we appreciate your listenership. But it'll help us to sort of climb the rankings if you leave a review, especially, I believe, on Apple Podcasts. So if you're enjoying the show and wouldn't mind dropping a comment, please do so and rate the show, and it'll help us out greatly. Thanks for that. All right, so a big change in mood we've had since the Monday session that was sort of truncated by the fact that the U.S. was on holiday yesterday, but we're getting suddenly much better vibes overnight, Asia rallying smartly with the notable exception of China. And you can see on slide two, there's two things to note. First of all, we're still surviving this 21-day moving average, which I really like as a sort of a short-term trend indicator. And then the second thing is that we still have a declining momentum situation if you look at something like the MACD. So we need to, to my mind, either get a nice, very strong rally session or two to get that momentum situation turned around. Until then, we're still a little bit of at risk here. And of course, the timing could not be more interesting because we have a massive transition going on, and that is the transition to a Biden presidency. More about that later. For now, Peter, anything else you're getting out of what's going on in equities and what we saw overnight in Asia, especially maybe the Chinese sort of outlier performance in the opposite direction?
Yeah, so we're looking at futures pricing today, which is very odd. You have Hong Kong futures, the Hang Seng futures up almost 3%, and you have the mainland, the CSI 300 that covers Shanghai and Shenzhen stocks down 1.5%. So a very huge divergence right there. I think it's mostly technical. I've been looking for clues to why that is. I don't think there's any meaningful explanation for this. I think the overall sentiment in equities have shifted, back towards that, I think, of reflation with the upcoming hearing of Janet Yellen and the 1.9 trillion stimulus coming to the U.S. And that's also why I've put in on the next slide, slide three, I believe, in our slide deck, Jeremy Siegel, which is a professor at Chicago. He was a student under Milton Friedman. He's famous for writing the book back in the old dot-com rally days, Dow 36,000, so which never really happened. I don't think it has happened yet.
Certainly not in inflation-adjusted terms.
Certainly not in inflation-adjusted terms.
Was it back in the 80s, late 80s or something? I can't remember.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, he wrote a big piece called "Higher Inflation is Coming, and it will hit bondholders." That was a big opinion piece in FT in today's paper. And his main argument is actually the one we have on the slide. So M2 is the sort of the money supply expansion that we have seen, which is extraordinary, as you can see on the year-on-year changes in the orange line there. We're up 27% year-on-year. He says that it's the highest increase in money supply. And he talked a little bit about the differences in the monetary policy operations during the financial crisis, where we had the quantitative easing that basically just shifted bad assets in the financial system with excess reserves, which created very little inflation because it was basically just assets or money being swapped from one account to another. But with the following interest paid on excess reserve, the financial system and the banks' balance sheets were slowly healed. And with the with the economy coming back, the U.S. financial system got back on its footing. But this time around, he says that the monetary operations are conducted in a very different way. So a lot of the expansion you're seeing in money not only hits excess reserves any longer, but hits direct pockets of companies and most importantly, individuals in the U.S. And that's why it will create higher prices in the economy. It will be much more demand-driven inflation that we'll see, and it will hit the bond market, according to Professor Siegel. But I just before I let this topic go, because we'll talk much more about this, I think, over the next 1.5 years, maybe 2 years, is that you can see there's a bump, but then the growth rate, this is a locked chart, if you look at the blue line, it's the slope of that line is almost the same as what you have seen prior to the bump up, and so that means that you could expect inflation to come higher short term, but then maybe settle back to its long term range, because in order for inflation to continue to move higher or stay at a high pace, you need constant more stimulus.
And the log growth would have to stay steady for that inflation to continue to increase at some higher rate. So that'd be very
Yes.
interesting. And just fact checking myself, so I didn't, so we don't have listeners writing in. I just looked at the date. It was 1999 he published that book.
That was what I said.
The times. Did you say that? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I
I
said during
said.
the.com days. So it doesn't matter.
Ah,
It's just.
okay. So yeah, but of course that was a bad timing, certainly with the stocks ready to correct within months of that. But just also perspective, just using your graph there. I mean, the U.S. The money supply back then was sub 5 trillion, and we've expanded the money supply by 400%, and we're still haven't reached that Dow 36,000. So difficult to make predictions. Can we safely say that, I think. And then what we're seeing also with the rebound in sentiment is a sell-off in U.S. Treasuries again, and that has the dollar weaker, but also the yen weaker, the yen even weaker than the dollar. And pointing out on slide four that we never really consolidated back into the or sort of pushed back into the trend, and we're still looking at the top of that trend if U.S. yields continue to rise. And as we pointed out ad nauseum, if U.S. rates are pushing to new highs, I think it starts to quickly become a destabilizing force, especially if they start pushing to new highs at any the rate similar to what we saw a couple of weeks back. So just can't underline enough the volatility risks that are injected if we get a strong rise in yields, and that's in part linked to the inflation story you just outlined there, and something we'll need to watch, especially as President Biden comes into office, and especially as we get those basing effect and inflation in the March, April timeframe, and then shortly beyond. But a key component of inflation as well, it's not just money supply, it's actually supply and demand for commodities, Ola. And one of those commodities that's been garnering increasing attention has been the grain sector. You've got some thoughts on wheat here and weather.
Indeed, John, and it's actually quite a worrying development because we've seen this continued rally in food commodities now for the past several months, and right now we're seeing an acceleration in wheat prices, soybeans, and that's obviously mostly towards animal consumption. But wheat is really one of the major staples together with rice, and we're now seeing the European wheat price surge to a 7-year high, joining the Chicago wheat, which is already on a tear. It is the introduction of export curbs out of Russia that will impact the supplies from the world's biggest exporter. At the same time, I was also showing here on slide five, we got a big cold blast currently across Russia, which is raising some concerns about the winter crop, it being well enough protected by snow. So it's all adding to the surge. And I just looked at the chart, and we saw the World Bank out last month basically warning that that this latest food price has aggravated the chronic and acute hunger in the less off countries. And obviously the pandemic is lowering incomes among people, and so it is something we definitely need to stay on top of. And just to as an example, we are if you look at milling wheat in Europe, we're now only around 12% below the peak that we saw back 10 years ago when we had the Arab Spring, and we are seeing protests starting to emerge various places because simply these prices are starting to become very painful. So it's one we need to watch, and I think especially something like wheat and rice prices.
And then on the crude oil front, still correcting, or still, there's not the bounce back we're seeing in equity, certainly in crude just yet. And I guess that's the demand picture, and especially COVID, I guess COVID on the ground, even in China.
Yeah, I think oil prices, given what the kind of news we had over the past week here, where we've seen the dollar strengthen, we've seen some of the reflation trade just taper off a little bit. Despite of this, crude oil is still within the uptrend that's been in place since November, finding support down towards this 54 level. And as you mentioned, John, the even though the longer term outlook is one for recovery as the vaccines start to have a positive impact, the short term outlook remains really, really challenged. We see lockdowns in Europe, in the US, the count is still disturbing the high, and now we're also seeing new counts in places where we haven't seen for a while, especially in China. So it's one that Well, it's not sending it down, but I for sure is struggling to find the arguments for sending it up at the same time. So we'll keep an eye today on the IEA's monthly oil market report. Just basically looking at seeing what they seeing if they're making any changes on their short-term demand outlook. I've inserted that on slide six. We can see we've had so far a downgrade from the EIA, a small downgrade from while OPEC maintained unchanged demand outlook. So let's keep an eye on the IEA later today.
Yeah, and then on sort of remaining a little bit on the inflation front here with the shipping costs. And we've talked about this before, and it's quite interesting. FT is finally starting to lead with an article about this issue with the cost of containers, especially the China to Europe shipping route. And what I didn't know was that they had actually moved to capped, I think probably for political reasons to avoid too much attention. They had capped the rates since October. To the US. So those were capped even if they'd gone up prior to that, whereas the European ones, I guess they saw less political exposure there and allowing market forces to dictate that they are where they are. And this is, I suppose, due to all the supply disruptions we saw back in the spring and then a sudden renewal of demand and the empty containers in the wrong place. But this is certainly, I don't know which one of you would like to take this, but this must, certainly become a threat at some point to both profit margins and really economic growth, if you will.
I'll just take the two slides, two charts first on the actual price, and then Peter can take it on the company level. I just inserted the Shanghai to Rotterdam, and you can just see how dramatic this change has been. We saw a run up ahead of New Year, and now this you can see in the top left, you've just got two data dots so far. We're basically trading around $9,000 per container. That is compared with the 5-year average around 2,000 for this time of year. And you can see the global prices as part of that. The composite is also at really elevated levels, and obviously it's having an impact on consumer costs and also on the profitability of transporting these containers, Peter.
You're absolutely right, and it's we know that logistic cost obviously is still it's not the majority of the overall price that ended up at consumers, but it's still meaningful, I would say, when we have seen such a big increase. I think the total cost for logistics is around 10% of an ordinary consumer good of around 100 euros. So I mean, when you have a few hundred percent moves, it does have an impact. But there are many variables in the consumer prices. It's I would say the most two most important things are basically what's the cost of energy. So energy cost being I think one of the big components, and the other one being, and that's one of the things that we are tracking, is the China PPI. So the prices that are coming out of producers, and we talked about it recently because we got the latest data points from December showing the prices continue to move higher from Chinese producers. And so if there are pricing pressures in China, that will be feeding directly into consumer prices. So we'll have to watch that as well. I think this, we have had some people with deep insight into the shipping industry writing to us after listening to our podcast, and what they're telling us is that a lot of this current situation that we're seeing is obviously there's a demand related element. There's a lot of stimulus that have taken the industry by surprise, but then this is mostly a logistics supply side bottleneck issue, and by nature that is temporary, and the prices are expected to come back. So I think as we talked about in our internal call, Ole and John, I think what we are looking at right now in terms of consumer prices and inflation is it's very much, I think it's the supply side, the bottleneck things that are is the biggest force. And then slowly as we progress through the years and we get more stimulus for both Europe and the US, I think that the demand side inflation will slowly take over being the most dominant force. And that's when the inflation story or reflation story becomes really interesting.
And I just inserted in that slide seven there also Maersk, which is obviously one of the world's biggest container shipping companies. As we entered into lockdowns last year, obviously the price collapsed as global trade was going to take a major beating. But since then, it's recovered. And I believe that's a record high we reached yesterday. It's up 210% from the low back in March. So so what a turnaround that has been.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you've pointed out with... With the earnings season incoming, and this is really going to be stealing the market's focus once we get to the other side of a Biden inauguration, I imagine. Netflix up already tonight, and you've pointed out there's some actual physical real world limitations in this very virtual company as well, simply because they have a hard time actually producing anything in this age of COVID because of all the of course the requirements for quarantine, etc. So take us through you had a good review of this yesterday, but any other thoughts on Netflix ahead of tonight's report?
Yeah, you can see from Q4 2019 in the small insert here on slide 8, you can see how the cash from operations have dramatically improved by almost a bit more than $2 billion, and that's because of the physical constraints on content production. But they will be ramping up that throughout the year. They just raised the target the other day. But then the Netflix story, as we talked about yesterday, is that it was a disappointing Q3, and they mitigated the negative impact of that announcement by banging on a strong rebound here in Q4. So I think the bar has been raised dramatically for Netflix, and I think the market, which you can also see from the pricing over the past 6 months, is very nervous about what's really coming tonight from Netflix. And I think Netflix, broader issue. I think Netflix it's going to be a fantastic company. It will be very profitable in the future. I don't think there's any investors out there that really, question that view. But the main question is, are you paying too much for the future of Netflix? I think ultimately that the $200 billion valuation will be justified. I think the entertainment and leisure time industry is definitely is a very profitable one. But I think you can get a pretty big correction in the meantime. The competition is heating up, and I think what have really helped Netflix over the past 10 years is that they were early on really grabbing the attention span in the entertainment and leisure space. But I think it's just such a competitive area. We with gaming and more different types of social media apps also trying to grab our attention. I think Netflix is really fighting for those eyeballs, and you have Disney that has entered the space, pulling all their content from Netflix as well. So I don't think it will be easy years for Netflix, or not as easy as the prior years. And they have a huge task ahead of them, because growth has slowed to almost zero in the North American market. So they will have to squeeze out a little bit more growth of Europe, and then it will predominantly become an emerging market growth story. And if they can't get that right, they have had issues in India, for instance. If they can't get that right, I think the narrative around Netflix will quickly change over the coming years.
All right. And then you had this one on the internal call, really interesting here, the actual earnings per share performance of the MSCI World relative to the S&P 500. And it's pretty shocking. I'll let you talk through it, but just looking at the MSCI World in dollar terms here, sorry, that's in local currency terms, at a dramatic new high in dollar terms, where we're still at a dramatic new high. All of it, obviously, based on rebasing relative to very, very low interest rates, not actually on earnings growth in any meaningful fashion at all.
Yeah, exactly. And there is a small typo in the chart. I apologize for that. It says 12-month rolling earnings per share, but it's actually the quarterly earnings per share. And that's also why you see that sharp drop last year. And now we have had the rebound in Q3, and now it's slightly higher here in Q4. But as you rightly pointed out, John, and I'll be writing something about this during the week, about this earnings growth. So it probably will be startling for people to know this fact, that if you take the current quarterly earnings per share here for Q4 with the numbers we have so far in the MSCI World, and you measure the annualized growth rate from the peak in Q2 2007, the annualized growth rate in earnings in nominal terms is minus 0.2%. So, and then if you subtract the inflation rate of, let's say, 1.5%, more or less, maybe you basically coming to a negative 1.5% annualized growth rate in earnings. And then you wonder, okay, how does that really stack up with the impressive bull market we've had in equities? And that's back to the interest rate story. So I think it's safe to say that if it hadn't been for the central banks and their lowering of the discount rate of future cash flows, then we would never have seen the rally we have seen in equities. But I think this chart is also a story about, that the we have an idea of a very prosperous and profitable corporate sector, but it's I think it's the divergences within the corporate sector is very big. And we know that it's the healthcare and the technology sector that has really been driving the earnings growth. So beneath the surface, I think you can see some pain around in the corporate sector. So, but I'll be talking more about this in an upcoming analysis on our research page.
Yeah, and then besides Netflix today, we have some of the big banks: Goldman Sachs, Bank of America. Anything you want to pull out of that?
No,
chart your really. Earnings calendar on slide 10 for the rest of the week as well.
Yeah, no, not really. They will mimic what we already saw on Friday from the big ones. I don't know why it's not red and bold, but tomorrow I think the most interesting one will be the ASML, which is the Dutch based domicile based company that has almost a 70% market share in lithography equipment, which is used to create the absolute top and best computer chips, semiconductors in the world, and they are basically a barometer on demand for computer chips. So and that's highly cyclical. So we'll, and also memory chips. So we'll be watching this one tomorrow. That's the key one.
All right, and let's look at the macro calendar. The highlight of the day, besides the German ZEW survey, is Secretary Yellen. Well, incoming Treasury Secretary Yellen, presumably, or the nominee at least, former Fed Chair Uber Dove. One of the most dovish Fed governors we've ever seen. Ironically, her prepared remarks were circulating, and she's talking a lot about the K-shaped recovery, the inequality out there, the need to go big on stimulus and bring up those that are suffering the most. Here's a Fed chair that is, although a career academician and not a Goldman Sachs alum, who's run around and done speeches too. The elites to the tune of $7 million since she retired, or she was renominated to head the Fed again by Trump. Just the irony there is somewhat bottomless, but I think it's interesting to see Yellen, the former Fed chair and sort of academic, talker speaking in typical Fed code, now having to play a much more political role and how she deals with that challenge, as well as not just the signals on the dollar, which have been much talked about. We talked about it yesterday as well, that she'll likely, or she is ready to say that the dollar should be based on market pricing and certainly not based on a weakening policy to gain a competitive advantage, but also the fact that the Treasury is the key contact point with China on especially things like tariffs, etc. So questioning on China, I think, will be kind of interesting in the hearing today. Looks like it, from what I can tell, is set to start at 10 o'clock Eastern. I believe that's 3 o'clock GMT. So definitely stay tuned for that. And then another factor, I just want to mention here, I don't have a chart or a graph or anything, but I think it's important. There's so much, and there's just endless focus on stimulus. What's the size of that? What is the content? What is, where will it be directed? But there's just a different thing that's happening here as well with the transition to a Biden administration. And that is, we are heading towards a completely different attitude towards governing. Instead of a hands-off attitude, which was very much the Trump style, light touch, and people appointing people to head various agencies, basically sometimes even to similar to what Reagan did back in the day and others, you appoint somebody that's almost against what that agency does. But in this case, specifically the SEC and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, if I'm saying that correctly, Gensler on the SEC, who is set to be a tough regulator and could be focusing on everything. I think this is very important. Retail trading, especially Robinhood, and whether these outfits are protecting investors sufficiently, but also potentially on the cryptocurrency side. I think this guy bears close watching as we transition to a Biden administration. As well on the CPFB, the Consumer Protection Financial Bureau, this character named Copra, I can't remember his first name, Rohit, apparently it was instrumental in creating the bureau, which has been completely dormant for the last 3-4 years. Also could be looking into issues geared towards financial protection. Just a very different attitude. I think there's a risk to markets from the regulatory side if there is a sufficient part of the speculative froth we've seen in pockets of the market that's been driven by maybe over exuberant behavior and options market trading. in U.S. equity. So it was, that'll be an interesting focus in coming weeks, months, and next 2 to 4 years, really, as well. So keep that in mind as we transition to the Biden presidency on Wednesday, Inauguration Day. And let's all hope for peace and quiet on the civil unrest front as well. For today, we'll call it a day, and we'll be back tomorrow with the Saxo Market Call. For today, thanks for joining.